He's been fantastic, but I also look forward with pleasure to working with my friend Mark, and I think it'll be great. So, I could talk about a lot of things, but I published at the end of November an annual report which reviewed the data we have on the public's health. So I'm not going to address those, nor am I going to address, you'll be pleased to hear, every disease in the NHS. I've chosen, and it's going to be fairly superficial, some issues from the public's health. Dementia, partly because it's a prime ministerial challenge, partly because Mark and I are champions for the Prime Minister at this moment on dementia research. I can't leave without mentioning the non-communicable diseases. I'll touch on infections, rare diseases, and our R&D response to some of these. And clearly, while government chief scientific advisors specialise in the basic science as well as the applied, you all know that I, in looking after the department's research budget, am most interested. I recognise the importance of the rest, don't forget that. But I am most interested in the clinical and the applied and the policy base, so that's where I'm going to focus. And I do want to say that I know that this is not a linear model, so don't assume I think it is as I talk. It does all loop back and work together, and anyone who's seen how we work very closely from NIHR with the MRC and the Wellcome Trust over the last decade would know that we all work closely together because there is a loop back. So let me start with the public's health, because what I'm looking at with you are threats and opportunities which present us with challenges, and they really do. I want to start with alcohol. It's the third highest behavioural risk factor for disease. You will all know that high alcohol intakes gives us our liver disease deaths, which I'll show you in a minute, but increased risks of cancers, let alone the violent crime. It's expensive for us. There were 6,500 deaths from conditions wholly caused by alcohol in 2010, and there were 1.25 million alcohol-related hospital admissions last year, let alone just under 1 million alcohol-related crimes last year. So this is a very important issue. The bit that really worries me is we haven't got it right, and we are the black line. And if you compare us to the EU15, which should be our comparators, they're all coming down in their alcohol deaths, and we're going up. We're going up by 20% over a 9-year period, and they're coming down by 20%. This is awful. And if you look at the cartogram on the right, and a cartogram's a map where the size of the bit of the map relates to the size of the population, and this one's taken from my annual report of liver deaths, you can see that there are areas where people are not dying of liver disease, which is predominantly alcohol, but the other causes are preventable. Their obesity and their infections, all preventable. That the northwest and northeast have particular problems, as well as the bit of London I live in. And indeed, we know that we have rising alcohol consumption in our young with binge drinking, and in middle age, particularly women who come home and need that glass of alcohol. So we have to address this. And this takes us into a lot of different arenas where we need research. It takes us into behavioural science, and more we're working with the ESRC and other behavioural scientists to get this right. We funded the modelling done by Sheffield University of minimum unit pricing, which the Prime Minister picked up, and we've just finished the consultation on a level of 45p per unit of minimum pricing. We've looked at a vast array of things. I'm not going to go into the detail, but I do want you to know that we are working hard to have evidence-informed policy on all of these challenges, but they are big challenges, and it involves growing a whole new set of researchers that we haven't classically tapped into and got doing this sort of thing. So we need the basic scientists, the biomedical scientists, the clinical scientists, and now we need all of those. What about obesity? It's pretty revolting, isn't it? And, well, it may be stabilising in children, it's still terribly high. And last year, 16% of children in the 2 to 15-year-old age were obese, and 30% overweight or obese. And again, our statistics look pretty appalling when you compare us to other countries. We know the US has a big problem. Interestingly, Australia's on the same trajectory as us, but there we are, bang in the middle. It is going up everywhere, but it is to do with that calorie-dense food. And to get this right, we're going to have to understand not only behavioural interventions, regulatory interventions, but actually the neuroscience, because we do know already, and I'm not the expert on this, but that the brain lights up in pleasure centres when we eat nice food, and there are circuits that maybe over time we can interrupt, perhaps with drugs, perhaps other ways. I do think that the pharmaceutical companies are looking for that magic drug to medicalise obesity. But that raises questions which you might consider a moral or ethical questions. If we could have a pill that prevented obesity, is that something the NHS should pay for? I could give you the cost-benefit and tell you whether it was worth paying for the NHS, but that's a different issue. It's raising a lot of problems. I was told only today that St Mary's Hospital, I don't know how true it is, Richard Sykes can tell us, he's in the audience, is having to build special facilities for the overweight patients. So it's costing the NHS a lot in morbidity and mortality. It increases your risk of cancer, liver disease and many things. We are working hard in this area. We have policy research units on behaviour and health, which are doing really groundbreaking work and work also with the Nudge unit of the Cabinet Office. We've co-fund with other people, including the MRC and Wellcome Trust, the National Prevention Research Initiative, and Cancer Research UK plays a big role. Again, with the same funders, the Public Health Research Centres of Excellence. And we have put $5 million a year into a school for public health research, looking at what interventions work to help reduce public health issues like that. So that gives you a feel for the public health jigsaw that we're struggling with. And I have to say we're struggling. We're watching these epidemics rise, and we don't have real handles on them. We could go a regulatory route, but then it will be a nanny state. And yet we haven't got a lot of other things yet. So let me pick up on ageing and dementia. John gave me a nice in by showing the changes in population that we're getting. And I can also show you from my annual report an age pyramid. Actually, what's quite interesting, and I got a lot of learning from my annual report, it's on the web if you want to see it, is not only are we ageing, but actually we're a growing population in England. This is English data. If you look at 2020, which are the paler bars, you can see even at the younger ages, it's enlarging. So we're getting a bigger population as well as an ageing population. And if you think about the fact that over 75, one in three will have dementia, and the global burden of disease, which is going to double by 2030, we have a real problem. And the problem with dementia is that a fair proportion, I think it's about 40%, but I can't remember, is caused by vascular disease. And we can do things about that. You know, we can control it by primary or secondary prevention of blood pressure, which is very important, statins, things like that. But the rest of it, we actually don't even know the cause yet. There's quite a lot of work to suggest pathways that we know are important, but we haven't found the causes. So we have very few disease-modifying treatments. There are some new antibodies that show a bit of promise, but because of our regulatory system, they reasonably are only being tried in late-stage disease. It may well be that we have to change our regulatory system or ask people who've got early-stage disease if they want to try these things. And there's no doubt that we need a lot more research. We need a lot more research across the whole area. And we're working together to more than double the spend on dementia research. So the MRC is doing the work. It's shown in the MRC purple. We've set up a translational research collaboration to pull through the basic science through our NIHR biomedical research centres and units. We've also done a themed call. We're going to spend $22 million on clinical and applied research. Working with the ESRC, they're spending $8 million of our money and $5 million of theirs on social research and how to look after patients better. So we're doing work across the whole spectrum. But actually, it's going to take more than this. And we have to think hard about how we can really move into that pre-competitive research, looking for what the true cause is, because it probably isn't one cause, for dementia are, and how can we interact with that to prevent it. We don't even have a really good diagnostic test, as a matter of fact. And we have a medical profession who, many of them think that, oh, the poor dear probably is getting dementia, but let's not tell the patient because it'll upset them and there's nothing to be done about it. When actually the evidence from social sciences is that people want to know, then they can set their lives in order. They might do things they want to do before they dement too much. But we have a medical profession who thinks the opposite. It's a very difficult problem. So let me take you into the non-communicable diseases. You will recognise this particular picture as coming from our Health Harms media campaign on smoking that we launched on December the 28th in order to catch the New Year's resolution of everyone. I'm lucky I've never smoked, so I don't know what it's like to be addicted. It's very difficult to stop people. Interestingly, we thought we were pitching at the people who smoke, and we were, but a lot of the feedback we're getting is from kids who say, I didn't know it was so revolting, I'm never going to start. It's a big problem. So clearly, if you smoke, you have an increased risk of cancer, of chronic airways disease, of cardiovascular disease. It's bad for you. And I want to just show you some of the work we've been doing in cancer, so I'm going to divert just for a minute and show you the dartboard of NIHR, the National Institute for Health Research, that we set up from the Department of Health to be the health research system in 2006. And we argued, and I can remember arguing it from this stage, that if you have a health system, you can overlay and interdigitate a health research system, and we can really deliver. And arguably, having started in 2006, and luckily I always said, I'm not promising a quick fix, we're doing quite well. And we do the things that government should do. We upskill people, the faculty. We fund market failure research, the research that no others will do, which is the clinical applied and policy. We fund the systems, Health Research Authority. But I want to pick up on the infrastructure. I've already mentioned the biomedical research centres and units, but we actually put a lot of money into managed clinical research networks, and these support industry and public sector trials by our partners, MRC, Cancer Research UK, many research charities, as well as our own. And the results in cancer are stupendous. 22.9% of cancer patients last year went into studies. If I tell you the truth about the states, that they can't hit 3% of patients going into studies, we now put more patients into studies to help their outcomes and to get the evidence and the answers than they do in the whole of the United States. So last year, just shy of 90,000 patients went into cancer studies, which was a fivefold increase on when we started the Cancer Research Network back in 2001. But it takes time to get there, but it really is getting there. So do you know what? We could have more than filled the Olympic Stadium with all those participants. The Olympic Stadium takes 80,000 people. In fact, over the last decade, we've recruited 250,000 patients to cancer research studies. And as you can see, year on year, it increases. And many of the studies are randomised controlled trials. Many of the others are collecting genotyping samples or whatever. So they're important studies. They've been through peer review. They're properly funded. This is important work. That takes me to genomic technologies. and the challenges here. The challenge for genomic technologies is multiple. One is we have a lead in the research in this nation, a lot of it down to Mark's leadership at the Wellcome, and I want to give credit to that. He really has led that, and our researchers have risen to the challenge and done some fabulous work. Can we translate that into having a health service that is at the cutting edge of genomics? Well, wouldn't it be good to? Meanwhile, there is that translational space between where we need to take the science and start to learn what it can mean for patients, and couldn't we, as we do that, generate some growth for this country? Now, you'd think that was easy, because really we ought to be able to do it. There is real potential, and we do have an opportunity with the NHS as a single national healthcare provider, but it's a complex healthcare provider. So, just before Christmas, and Minister Willetts came up to Cambridge with a number of us to launch it, the government launched an initiative to sequence 100,000 whole genomes on NHS patients with a focus on cancer, rare diseases, and infectious disease. My minister, Jeremy Hunt, had earmarked up to 100 million to pump prime the sequencing, train the workforce, and support commercial applications. It was, in the way things are in government, quite messy getting to that point, but we got there. And I went home at the end of that day and thought, great, we got there. And being me, lay there and thought, oh shit, what we haven't done yet is work out how we're going to do this. And what we'd said, and we have to stick to, is that the procurement would be done by the NHS Commissioning Board that has not a scientist in it. So I have been trying to help the chief executive of the Commissioning Board understand that if I'm the chief scientific advisor for the department, then I am for all its arm's length bodies, so I'm his. I think he knows that, but you know, science is messy, and does he really want to go there? But I then went to Jeremy Hunt and said, look, there's a whole pile of science policy issues that I think we should sort out because there's science policy in the department, and hand over to the Commissioning Board. And he was kind enough to agree. So I've set up, with advice from Mark, John Saville and Harpal Kumar, three groups looking at the science priorities, the principles underlying which ones we should do, because I'm determined the money should not be used for what I would call NHS substitution. In other words, flowing into the NHS and doing the genomics they would have liked anyway, but to deliver something new that will benefit us. On data, the data structure, the storage, that has been chaired by Janet Thornton, and on the ethics of it, you know, what sort of consent, if we need consent, data exclusivity, all the questions like that. And to advise me, so that I can tell the Secretary of State by the end of April, the three groups have had their first meetings, the rest of the meetings are set, and it's all going forward. Meanwhile, the chair of the Commissioning Board has his first meeting of his strategic board this Friday afternoon, but as people were only given 4 days' notice, I guess many won't make it, but I hope a lot do, because I've packed it with ace scientists like Mark and John Saville so that they can advise on the procurement. And it's going to be an interesting roller coaster. Let me quickly move on to infections. And I don't need to talk about pandemic because John did it for me, but we do work hard at that. We do plan very carefully. And you'll be interested that we actually have already funded 9 sleeping contracts for when we next have a pandemic, that we can just, they've already had money, they've got their protocols, their ethics committee permissions, we can just press the button and go live. Because last time we did some very good work quickly, but next time we're going to do even better. But I have been working on a volume 2 of my annual report, and this is an expert report written by the scientific experts. My role is to bring it together and comment on infection I have to say I chose infection because I thought it wouldn't be particularly inflammatory or difficult. And what I understood and learnt from this was that antimicrobial resistance, since I last prescribed antibiotics about 8 years ago, has become very serious. And many of you will have heard that I am sponsoring now us as a government, as a nation, to take a leadership role, not only in how we handle it internally, but this is not something that we can do on our own. It is something we have to do internationally under the leadership of not only the World Health Organization, but with the animal part and the DEFRA and the whole government. It is now on the risk registers of ourselves and DEFRA. It is moving forward. Indeed, Number 10 have told one of my colleagues that they've explained to me the importance of antimicrobial resistance. So I think we're really making progress on getting this to the top of the agenda. And I was misquoted, so poor John had his office ring me up and say, "I hear you don't believe in climate science," to which, of course, I believe in climate science. What I said, and the chairman of the committee is here so he can substantiate it, was we might not live to see the climate change if this really gets going, which it could do. We're doing a lot of work and we're looking at doing yet more with the MRC. The last thing I thought I'd just pick up on was rare diseases, because, you know, 7% of patients in the NHS have rare diseases, and if we understand them, it actually opens up a lot of good science, which then takes us into new treatments for more common diseases. The statins came that way. And we're funding a lot of work through our biomedical research centres and units on phenotyping. And actually, we've just given significant money, I think £15 million for genome sequencing of patient cohorts with rare diseases, as well as money to biobank for some genomics. And all of this is being done in this environment that gets ever more complex and includes now academic health science networks and will include in the future academic health centres. So my final point I want to make is we're not going to deliver what we need to if we exclude half the workforce. And I looked up the figures on gender and academia. In the biological sciences, it's about 22% are women. Chemistry and physics, it's the upper teens. It's really good. For academic medicine, it is 11%. Yet over 50% of the students coming out of medical schools are female. And they're going through and they're doing the PhDs. And it came to my attention in a big way, as I watched with an international panel, the fact that there were no leaders who were women in front of this international panel. And the international panel said, this is dreadful. And economically, we're losing out. We're discarding 50% of our best brains. So I have set a challenge to all the medical schools in a letter which I sent out in August 2011, which is, we won't shortlist them for massive amounts of money unless they get the Swan Athena Silver Award and show they're taking this seriously. And I know they are, but it is proving quite a challenge for all of them. So I've discussed quite a lot of issues here, very superficially, happy to get into them more. But what I think it does demonstrate for you is the multitude of threats and wealth of opportunities that we face in the health arena, but also that we can't solve it on our own. We can only solve it working together. And that's not only with social sciences, but with the basic scientists and across government. And I think that's part of the pleasure of this role. So let me hand over to my friend.